This is Case Closed, crime stories from the golden age of radio.
Get this and get it straight. Crime is a sucker's road, and those who travel it wind up in the gutter, the prison of the grave. This time each carried a torch and each was burned by it. The heel, the hero worshiper, and the hard-bitten blonde. And all because of a woman already 2 days dead.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character in The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. In just a moment, tonight's story. But first, a message from the Ford dealers of America.
Tonight, more than 110,000 enthusiastic motorists own new 1950 Fords. Here's what Donald L. Gibson, a pilot from Kansas City, says about his 50 Ford.
As a pilot, I'm naturally interested in engines, and that's why I bought a 50 Ford. That V8 really ticks along. And ticks is just the right word, because it's as smooth and quiet as the Swiss movement and a good watch. And it's not just the Ford engine that's fine. The ride is just like flying in smooth air, and the car handles like a dream. Anyone who's thinking of buying a new car should certainly take a check ride in the 50 Ford.
We Ford dealers are swamped with comments like that. But don't take anyone's word for this new 50 Ford. Prove it for yourself. Look up your nearest Ford dealer in the classified phone directory, or perhaps you know him personally. He'll arrange a test drive in the 50 Ford. Test drive it for comfort, for power, for safety, and for the quietness, which is its mark of quality. Yes, before you buy any car at any price, test drive the 50 Ford at your Ford dealers tomorrow.
Now, with Gerald Moore, starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's exciting story, The Torch Carriers.
The 8 hours that had just slipped away had been a noisy assortment of big people with little troubles I hadn't wanted to help, and little people with big troubles I hadn't been able to help. So by the time it was all over and I was heading for home, a cozy, quiet cocktail lounge at the Wilshire Gardens Hotel seemed like a good idea. When I was there, up at the bar with one down and one to go, the strain that had been with me all day began to ease up. But even as I relaxed, the tension between the couple sitting at my left became more and more apparent. I looked down the bar. The girl was young, pretty, and obviously afraid of the little man with her, who had only asthma where a voice should have been.
Now, have I made myself clear?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Now, look, sister, Larry Sower doesn't go for people snooping after him, not. And neither do I. It gives me work to do that's sometimes rough on a party.
Brave boy. All right, little man, you've had your busy day.
Hey, take your hands off.
As soon as you relax.
Okay, get your mitts on.
Now, gentlemen, please, no fighting. I can lose my license for it. Now, you leave at once.
Wait a minute, Baldy.
You heard him, Buster.
Okay. I said what I come to say anyhow.
Walter, stop playing.
You all right, miss?
Yes, thank you.
Are you sure? Would you like another drink?
No, thank you. I think I'll go back to my villa.
Oh, you're staying here at the Wilshire Garden?
Yes, Villa 12. It's just around the corner.
Well, maybe I better see you as far as the door. Little pal of yours might still be around.
Well, thank you.
All right, come on.
This is really very nice of you, Mr.
Marlowe, Philip Marlowe. What about you?
What? Oh, Claire Osborne.
Well, now look, Claire, I'm not trying to pry into your business, but in a way, people like Larry Salter are my business.
Larry Salter? How did you know about him?
Your little pal in the bar wasn't whispering.
Oh.
I'm a private detective, Claire, and I see a lot of people get in over their heads. Hate to see it happen to you. You know, these people play rough, usually for keeps. Maybe you better tell me about it, huh?
Well, this is my place.
Oh.
Mr. Marlowe, I'll be frank with you. A month ago, I got into a jam. It was an investment I'd made, some stock, a sure thing I was told.
Yeah, they usually are.
Anyhow, the certificates weren't quite gilt-edged, and they took a dive, a deep one. And to protect myself, I needed more money, so I took a bracelet. I had a diamond one and got a loan on it.
From Larry Salter?
Yes, from Salter. A friend, a person I thought was a friend, recommended him to me. So
you cashed your bracelet, covered your investment, got your money back, and now you want the bracelet again, correct?
Yes, but Salter isn't around. He's hiding.
How do you know?
Well, I went to the club he runs up on the strip. I overheard it there.
Oh.
Two men spoke of him as being on a an extended vacation for his health. But of course, I didn't believe that, so I went around the back, found the door open, and got into Salter's private office.
Baby, that in itself is a wonderful way to get into trouble deep.
Yes, I know, but I just had to find out where Salter could be located so I could pay him and get my bracelet back. Here, look. It's this paper.
Mm-hmm.
It was folded under Salter's memo pad. On one side, it says, Madge, Gladstone 274. The last number's missing, torn off. And on the back, meet at 1010. Can this help us, Emma?
Yeah, it might. But first, Claire, a couple of questions that might help even more. Who was that ersatz Little Caesar who slapped you in there?
One of the men I overheard talking at Salter's club. He must have seen me and then followed me here.
That figures. Now, look, honey. You're scrambling awful hard for a $1,000 bracelet. What's the rest of it?
The rest of it? Well, you're out of your...
Honey.
Oh, what's you?
That's better.
I might just as well tell you. The bracelet isn't mine, Mr. Marlowe. It belongs to my aunt. I live with her in San Diego.
Oh, you borrowed it while she was away, maybe, huh?
Yes. Oh, please, I've learned my lesson. I only want to get that bracelet back now, Mr. Marlowe. Please, please, will you help me? I'll pay you anything.
Never mind that now.
Oh, please, I must know where Larry Salter is.
Okay, Claire, we'll try to find out, but on one condition, huh?
Which is what?
That you go inside, lock all doors and windows, sit next to the phone, and until you hear from me again, do absolutely nothing on your own. Agreed?
Oh, yes, agreed, Mr. Marlowe. Thank you very much.
Maybe it was because the sweet young kid had the kind of voice you could still hear long after she was gone. You know, one of those lingering sounds, like the echo of a train whistle hanging on crisp early morning air. But when I was at a payphone, I stopped wondering and started dialing numbers prefixed Gladstone and followed by 274 and then in order 123 and so on until after no answer once, wisecrackers twice, and a babysitter who thought I was a masher from her high school, I finally scored at number 5. The answer took me to a dame named Madge Gilbert at a place called the Beekman Plaza. It wasn't the kind of place you'd go for mother, and Madge Gilbert wasn't the kind of girl mother would put up with. However, she must have been nice to look at once. And from the smile, pleasant to know.
Okay, Mr. Busy Guy, now that we're together, what is it?
Well, for one thing, the name's Kirby, and you can drop the fancy handle.
Uh-huh. And for another thing, Kirby?
I want to find Larry Salter, but quick.
Why?
Got a proposition for him.
He won't be interested. Sit down.
How can you tell? You don't know what it is.
No, but I do know what at the moment Larry is.
Yeah?
And in three letters, my friend, the word is sad. He lost his lady love. Drink?
No, thanks. What do you mean, his lady love? I heard that you and
Never
Larry...
Never mind what you heard.
Uh-huh.
All that used to be. The pre-Janice trial period.
The sad comes from Janice finding a better deal, maybe, huh?
No. She was killed. Automobile accident. Night before last.
Salter with her?
No, again. She was alone and drunk. Now, that's probably the way Larry is right now. A blind fool. Fill it up, will you?
Sure. Look, baby, believe me, it won't put out the torch you're carrying.
Shut up. Sorry I brought the whole thing up. Now, what was that proposition you mentioned?
For Larry exclusively. Where is he?
The foundry on Cushing.
Where?
The foundry in East Los Angeles. Hey, wait a minute, Kirby. You seem kind of lost for a friend of Larry's.
Well, I'm just fuzzy on locations, that's all.
How about numbers? The address down there, what is it? Come on, fast.
1010. Unless it's been changed recently.
It hasn't. Okay, busy guy, you're still all right.
Thanks. And if you play it real close, I think you'll be too. See you, Madge. Cushing Avenue in East Los Angeles is industrial, literally wrong side of the tracks and about as non-Hollywood as an honest day's work. And all the way there, I kept blessing the dumb luck that had made me answer 1010 for the address before I'd even had time to think. When I pulled up and parked away from the place, I hoped that luck would continue. Because ahead was the foundry, or what remained of it, and in no sense did it look like friendly territory. I found a metal staircase climbing from what had once been a loading ramp up to the yard foreman's office where a single, staring, unshielded light inside said that somebody was home. And when I'd quietly gone up those stairs, I saw through a glass door who that somebody was. Larry Salter. Alone next to a telephone and pitching darts at a smiling face on a calendar across the wall that read, January 1928. And I knocked with the barrel of my .38 on the dirty glass door. Told me to come in without looking up.
Make yourself at home, neighbor. Be with you in a minute. Aha! I did it. Your front tooth have been trying for that all night.
So glad you made it. Now it won't be on your mind while we talk.
About what?
Bracelets.
Bracelets? Neighbor, this is an iron foundry. What you want is a jewelry shop.
Let's save each other a lot of time and level, huh? I'm a private detective named Marlowe Salter, and at the moment working for Claire Osborne, who now has the price of a bracelet. Wants it back in a hurry. Do we do business?
No, we don't. And it's not because I don't like you, neighbor.
But?
But because, one, I never heard of any Claire Osborne. Two, bracelets are stuff for second story men, which I am not. And three, you ought to get yourself a pair of sneakers, stupid. You've been followed all the way through the yard, up the stairs, and into this room.
An old gag, Salter.
No, no gag. So while you still can, you better put that gun away, because my boy Cover takes a strange delight in messing people up. Real bad.
You're bracketed, chum. You better drop it fast.
Yep.
That's better. Now, Marlowe, without any double talk about babes and bracelets, let's have it. You're one of Freeman Best's boys, aren't you? You think I had something to do with him getting knocked off in that ditch? You're here to square things away. That's it, isn't it?
No, it isn't. To get your hands off me.
Okay, I won't touch you again. But that's more than I can say for Cobra.
Yeah, lots more.
Oh. It was a toss-up whether Cobra's gun on the side of my head or the side of my head on the floor had done the damage. But either way, it didn't seem to matter. Because I couldn't make it back any further than Larry Salter's voice. It sounded like it was coming from the bottom of the well. Even though I could see him talking into the telephone.
Okay, my place later.
Oh.
It's 8100 North Lucerne in Hollywood.
But then,
no.
I couldn't even see that anymore. Listen, I'm over in East Los Angeles.
Mr. Marlowe, did you find him? Do you know where Larry Salter is?
Yeah, I think so. 8100 North Lucerne. It's up in Hollywood near you. Now listen, Claire, about the bracelet.
There is no bracelet.
What?
There was no aunt, no trouble on the stock market, and no loan made.
Why do you want to know where Salter is? What do you want from him?
His life. Goodbye, Mr. Marlowe.
Wait a minute, Claire. Claire, listen to me.
I wouldn't try it, Jim.
What? Hey, Cobra, listen,
Shut up. You don't have to go no place until Larry Salter comes back and says so. Now relax, chum.
In just a moment, the second act of Philip Marlowe. But first, a brief message from the Ford Dealers of America.
Over 100,000 motorists are experiencing the engineering leadership built into the 50 Ford. As owners, they already know that it's the one fine car in the low-priced field, and it's personal experience that counts in buying a car. That's why the Ford Dealers of America are issuing this special invitation to test drive this new 50 Ford for yourself. In the classified phone directory, you'll find the name of your nearest Ford dealer. Perhaps you know him personally. He'll be delighted to arrange a test drive tomorrow. So get behind the wheel and test drive it for the comfort of its midship ride and its unmatched roominess. Test drive it for the power and quietness of the only V8 in the low-priced field, the kind of engine found in America's costliest cars, yet priced lower than 10 different six-cylinder cars. Test drive it for the safety of its own king-size brakes, largest in the low-priced field. Before you buy any car at any price, you'll find it to your advantage to test drive the 50 Ford at your Ford dealers tomorrow.
Now with our star, Gerald Moore, we return to the second act of Philip Marlowe and tonight's story, The Torch Carriers.
I turned to the poker-faced Cobra and the .45, both staring at me from across six dusty feet of concrete floor that made the ancient East L.A. foundry seem colder and even more lonely.
You don't stay put so good, do you, sweetheart?
You're kind of heavy-handed with that gun, aren't you, Cobra?
You want to try again, sweetheart?
I'll pass. Standing here staring at each other is apt to get dull, don't you think?
That's entirely up to you, sweetheart. You bleed pretty.
You'd like that, wouldn't you, kid? Look, just so I don't get plugged by mistake... Better let me sit down before I fall down, huh?
Help yourself. Over there on that box, so we keep me between you and the door. That's right. You're a good boy.
You got no idea. Hey, come on, how long do we play like this?
I'll tell you better when Orville the Squeak gets back.
What's Orville the Squeak?
She runs errands for Larry, like finding out what's phony about a certain young babe in her bracelets that don't exist.
So that's where the bird with the whiskey soprano fits. That's the way the punk operates, huh? Well, that way, Cobra, we'll both die of old age before... All right, you hear that? Somebody moved downstairs. Maybe this is visitor's night in the old foundry.
Don't get your hopes up, sweetheart. Those live here. They're rats. They eat small dogs. And one thing more, Marlowe.
What's that for, punk?
Dropping your hands out of your lap where I couldn't see them. Don't try it again.
Now put it on your bill. You know, Cobra, you're holding me here on Larry Salter's orders, and yet I'm the only one who knows what schedule I happened to him tonight.
Maybe you better tell me.
Sure, sure. Only first I want to know something. What about the late Mr. Freeman Best?
Freeman was scum. Low, stinking scum. Nobody misses him. I mean nobody. And Larry didn't kill him, that's out.
But he was connected, wasn't he? And there was a girl named Janice Trow. How does she figure?
You better let that one set, sweetheart, for your own sake. Now, let's have your end and fast. What's supposed to happen? Did you hear?
Hear what? Don't tell me a tough boy like you gets jumpy.
Skip it. All right, Gib, come on, wise boy jabber.
Look, Cobra, won't do you any good. Anyway, I'm the only one who...
Shut up. There was something.
Maybe your rats are big enough to wear shoes. Huh?
Shut up, I said. And sit right there, or I'll blow you in two, and I mean it.
Orville? Orville? Hey, Squeak, is that you? Who's out there? Answer me!
As Cobra edged out of the room, I felt along the side of the box I'd been sitting on for a jagged chunk of metal slag I'd spotted earlier. It was about the size of a baseball and heavy. I picked it up, then moved across to the opposite wall near the door.
You, get out of here! The boss is through with you. Now beat it!
I stepped out and saw Cobra standing at the head of the stairs, his back to me. I threw the lump of iron slag with everything I had. Caught him like a hammer between the shoulder blades. His head flew back, his fingers clawed at the air, and he pitched face first down the stairs. I caught a glimpse of a woman ducking out of sight behind the foundry furnace. It was Madge Gilbert.
You killed him, didn't you? Cobra's dead?
I don't know, and I don't care. What are you doing in this boarded-up rat trap?
There's nobody else here. Just us and Cobra.
Creepy number they call over the squeakers do any minute.
That nasty little loss gives me the willies.
You made your bed, baby, but let's not get lost. What are you after in here?
Oh, I've been thinking plenty about that torch you're talking about. I decided if you carry the same old one long enough, you're bound to get burned.
Finally felt the heat, huh?
Yeah, plenty. So I came here looking for you, or Larry.
Couldn't make up your mind.
Certainly. I wanted to tell Larry I was through with him.
He'd have beat you to it, but you found me, so?
Okay. What if Larry or the Squeak come back after what I'm going to tell you? You got to help me get out of here. Larry'd kill me.
Okay, kid, let's have it.
You wanted to know about Janice Trout.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you. She was beautiful. I'd be the first to admit it. A brunette like every woman wishes she was. And Larry fell for her. She took him away from me just like I'd been dead 10 years. Only she was rotten. Never once a clean thought in her twisted, dirty little brain.
So says the jealous lover.
Jealous? Sure, I was jealous at first. And just hurt and disgusted. She was double-crossing Larry every time he turned around, but there was nothing I could do. I tried to tell him...
So far, it's strictly stock, Madge.
Yeah. All but this. One time I made it stick. She borrowed Larry's car to take that slimy Freeman Best out for a ride in it. With extra laughs, because it was Larry's car, mind you. And Freeman Best, in case you haven't heard...
I've heard.
Well... I got a lead that they were going to wind up at the Bridge Cafe. I made Larry take me out there to prove what I'd been telling him about Janice was true.
You proved it?
Sure. We waited for him at the bridge. They showed up all right, doing 90. She couldn't make the curve, and they hit the bridge railing. He killed them both.
Wait a minute. You're stretching, baby. Freeman Best's body was found 30 miles south.
Sure it was, because Larry couldn't bear the idea of Janice Trow being found with Freeman Best. He tried to protect her and keep everybody from finding out what a tramp she really was. He pulled Freeman's body out of the wreck and hauled it clear down to Long Beach and dumped it. I watched him do it.
And all this business is just to keep that secret about Janice Trow, huh?
Sure. Gee, can you imagine a love like that going to waste, huh? Why, even with her dead, even now, he won't as much as speak to me. I'm not so bad. I've tried and I've waited... But he won't drop it. So it's all yours, Kirby, and take it. I hope you put it right where it hurts him the most.
No dice, baby. Kirby was a stall. I'm Marlowe, private detective.
What? Gee, how cheap did I sell out anyway?
That depends. The only axe I'm grinding is for a girl named Claire Osborne. Ever hear of her?
No.
That's funny. For some reason, she hates Salter even more than you.
It's horrible. It's horrible.
You stay where you are.
I'm scared of him, Mom.
I'll pull his fangs. Just don't get absent-minded about which side you're on.
Hello, Orville.
Where's Larry?
I don't know. I've been waiting for him.
Where's Cover, then? I got something important.
Cover? Oh, why, he went out for a few minutes.
Yeah? I don't like this, sister. You in here all by yourself. Something's wrong. What is it? Come on, what's the matter?
Marlowe!
Hold it, Orville.
You. Why the gun?
Guess. What do you know about Claire Osborne?
I don't think I know the party.
Sure you do. A cute little brunette named Claire Osborne. I want the straight dope on her, and I want it now, not later.
Go over. Hey, go
Answer
over.
My questions, you creep.
You won't get anything out of me. Larry will take care of both.
You jerk. Maybe there's something on it'll give me an answer without talking back.
Look, he always wrote things down in a little notebook. It's inside his jacket.
Yeah, you're right. Here it is. Let's see. Oh, sure, this is it. Claire Osborne arrived from San Diego last night by plane. Registered at Wilshire Gardens as Claire Osborne, but according to driver's license, her real name is... For Pete's sake, no wonder. I'll see you, kid. It took me 20 minutes to get from East L.A. over to Lucerne and another 5 to find the bleak white bungalow that belonged to Larry Salter. Its front windows were dark when I drove past it, parked on a side street, and walked back. But in the rear, one window showed a light. The screen door was open, so I eased myself into the service porch where I could see Salter sitting at a kitchen table. A look on his face of hurt defiance, like a small boy accused of something he hadn't done. I couldn't see who was facing him, but there was no mistaking the voice.
I love my sister.
It was Claire.
Everything to me. And now she's dead and you killed her. That's true, isn't it?
I've already told you once, kid, you're making a mistake.
Oh, no, I'm not. You're going to pay for my sister's death. No court will ever call it murder, but that's what it was. You did it just as surely as if you'd strangled her with your own hands. And now I'm going to get even for Janice.
Claire.
Hey, what?
Marlowe, you crazy fool. Why did you come here?
Give me that gun, Claire.
I know, you stay out of this. You can't stop me. Nobody can. Even if you shoot me, Marlowe, I'll kill him
first. Now listen to me. Before you start pulling that trigger, you better know all the facts. Everything Salter here has done since your sister's death has been to shield and protect what little she herself left of a good reputation. She turned bad, Claire.
You're lying.
No, no. What reason have I got to lie? I'm telling you this because it's true and I can prove it.
I don't believe you. You're trying to trick me.
It was your big sister who tricked you years ago. She was no good. That double-crossing dirty cheater wouldn't shoot square for 5 minutes.
Stop it,
Frank. Now there's more. The night she died, she was two-timing Larry. But even in spite of that, he risked his neck to move the body of the other guy just so she wouldn't be found with the kind of cheap trash she'd been running around with. And do you know why? Because Larry Salter there loved your sister, loved her every bit as much as you did.
Loved her?
Yeah.
Oh, no. No, this can't be true.
Yes, it's true, kid. All of it. I loved her, all right. It's just too bad that Janice went like she did.
Oh, Marlo.
Okay, baby, the hard part's over. Come on, come on, give me the gun. You don't want to shoot anybody. Not now. Better now, Claire?
Yes, I'll be all right when I get used to a few new ideas.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to me now?
Well, that's pretty much up to you.
How do you mean?
The world spins like mad, honey. You have to keep up or get lost.
Like I was tonight.
Mm-hmm.
I was lost, Marlo, terribly. Everything I had any faith in was gone.
Yeah, I know. That's because you had blind faith, Claire. You know, that's okay for kids, but you're a big girl now.
Oh, yes, I get it. From now on, it's me, on my own 2 feet, and my eyes wide open.
Well, take it easy, baby. It's fun to close them once in a while. After I dropped Claire off at her hotel, I remembered the drink I'd started out to get and left half-finished on the bar. But it was too late now to stop anywhere, so I drove home and poured myself a nightcap in my own apartment. I carried it over to the window and looked out across the city at the endless miles of winking lights, each one a torch. Everybody carries a torch for something. Some for a love they can never have. An ideal that's out of reach. And some just for memory. Funny thing. So many dark corners get their only light from a torch that somebody carries.
Philip Marlowe will be back in just a moment, but first, here's a message from the Ford dealers of America.
More than 110,000 delighted motorists are already driving the new 50 Ford. Here's what Jack Farrell, hotel manager, says.
I did a lot of shopping around and chose Ford for styling, and I'm certainly glad because I found there's plenty of car beneath its beautiful body. There's plenty of power under the hood, too, and it's as comfortable as a high-priced car. I could go on for hours about the quietness, the economy, and the comfort of my car, but it all adds up to this. The 50 Ford's a mighty fine car to own.
We Ford dealers are not surprised that new owners rave about their 50 Fords. We've studied this new Ford from stem to stern. We know every detail of its 50 ways new for 50. But until you get behind the wheel, you won't be able to believe how good it is. That's the reason we want you to test drive the 50 Ford. The classified phone directory will give you the name of the nearest Ford dealer. Or perhaps you know him personally. Why don't you phone him tomorrow? Before you buy any car at any price, you owe it to yourself to test drive the 50 Ford.
Be sure and be with us again next week when Philip Marlowe says...
This time everything that happened from the orange-haired man with a map past the oaf for the pitchfork to the body at the covered bridge was wrong. Dead wrong.
adventures of Philip Marlowe, bringing you Raymond Chandler's most famous character, star Gerald Moore, are produced and directed by Norman McDonald and are written for radio by Robert Mitchell and Gene Levitt. Featured in the cast were Sammy Hill, John Daner, Vivi Janis, Harry Bartell, Wilms Herbert, and Edgar Berrier. The special music is composed and conducted by Richard Orant. This is Roy Rowan speaking. Stay tuned now for Gangbusters, which follows immediately on most of these same CBS stations. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum. Here in the grim stone structure on the Thames which houses Scotland Yard is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a paperweight, a woolen muffler, an old-fashioned hatpin, a drinking glass, all are touched by murder. Here's a bit of frosted glass. It's a familiar object. You've seen such glass before in the upper panels of the doors of older houses, and perhaps the one in which you live. Let's in more light, the owner used to say. One man climbing to his old-fashioned apartment said to his son,
"Hello, what's this? Glass on the landing?"
"On the door, Dad. It looks like a frosted panel fell out."
"Yes, and pretty jaggedly. Be careful, son. Those shards are sharp."
Well, today the glass shards can be seen in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Museum, starring Orson Welles.
And here we are, the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's Museum of Murder. As here lies death. Here's a pacifier, nippled end, ivory ring. This in the Black Museum, yes. As it seems, there was a will. And where there's a will, there's a way. Even to infanticide. Here's a pair of andirons. Brass, graceful in pattern, clean in execution. Execution. Observe the shining brass of this one, the ugly blotch on the other. A woman is pushed violently. Her head strikes with malice aforethought. And this was murder. Nice. Here we are, the glass shards. They're sharp, pointed. Dangerous to life and limb, even in themselves. Here they are, glistening, gleaming in their whitely frosted danger. Once they were part of a whole. The glass panel, as I told you, of an apartment door. But we'll come to that. Let's begin this tale with the ringing of a doorbell.
Maybe no one is home. Well, we'll try again.
Sorry to have kept you waiting.
Sorry to have disturbed you, ma'am. I've been sent looking for a chauffeur. Chap name of Simmons.
There's no one here by that name. And I can tell you, sir, there's no one by that name being in this neighbourhood. Well, not in my memory, and I've lived here about 20 years.
Oh, well, thank you, ma'am. Garage really works, the Beacon, it's called. Well, they'll have to find another errand boy if they can't give me better steers than this. Well, good day, ma'am.
Good day. That's a bit strange. There's no Beacon Garage in this neighbourhood.
Of course, this was not a neighbourhood for garages and items of that sort. This was strictly residential. Mostly semi-detached houses with a bit of garden and an occasional block of apartments, or flats, as they're still called in London. Into one of those apartment houses came Charles Fly and his son, Charles Jr., home after their respective days' work at business and college.
When will they put lights in these stairs, Dad?
Not if someone breaks a leg in the dark. I just hope it isn't your mother.
So do I. Well, watch the landing. Dad turns just ahead.
I know. Hello, what's this? Glass on the landing?
From the door, Dad. Looks like the frosted panel fell out.
Yes, and pretty jaggedly. Be careful, son. Those shards are sharp.
I said, do you suppose Mother let the door slam so hard the glass broke?
Well, I'll ask her when we get inside. Your key handy?
Right here, Dad.
Thanks. Funny, I've never known your mother to use the chain on the door in her life.
Oh, with the glass broken like that?
What good's the chain? I can reach in and flip off the chain from here through the broken glass.
Dad, there's someone in there.
Oh, your mother, probably. No, it's not. It's a man. A little fellow. Junior, yes? Get on down to Riverdale Road. There's a police box there. Call him, quickly.
What about you, Dad?
Go on now. I'll stay here and watch him. Hurry.
Yes, all right. If you say so.
Chain's off now. Why not? He's only a little fellow. Here now, what are you putting in my suitcase?
You shouldn't have come in, Governor. It won't do you a bit of good. I'm leaving with your suitcase and what I've packed in it.
The pit bag! I can handle you. Oh.
So foolhardy. Mr. Fly should have stayed outside. He might have stayed alive. As it was when the police did arrive with Charles Fry Jr., Senior was very dead. The call to Scotland Yard was automatic after that. Inspector Howard proceeded with the preliminary questioning as his technical experts combed the apartment.
I know you had quite a shock, my boy, but we need your help, and right now.
I'll try my best, Inspector.
We've checked the apartment. The intruder, whoever he was, had packed a suitcase and was about ready to leave.
It's Dad's own. It was his suitcase.
All right. Now, is there anything else you know of that's missing?
Mother said something before she collapsed about her bracelet. I looked. It's missing.
Can you describe it in detail? On items like that, we publish it in the Yard's Daily Gazette. It's circularized to every station, jeweler, and pawn shop in England.
It was gold, about an inch wide, engraved with a kind of floral design, and there were 25 diamonds, small ones, in the pattern. Dad gave it to Mother on her 25th anniversary.
I see. Very good. Now, you've been in excellent health, and you're certain he was a short man.
Well, I saw him through the broken pane. He was just about 5 feet tall. Quite a little fellow. I guess that's why Dad went in after him. Dad didn't... No, he had a gun.
Housebreakers try to stay away from guns in England. The penalties are too severe. Yes, Sergeant?
No M.O., sir. Just the broken pane of glass.
Thank you. Anything beyond that first shell?
Not a thing. One shot was fired, that's all.
No M.O., sir.
Means of operation. Anything that's recognizable. Most of these people have a kind of trademark. Completely subconscious, but it helps us to find them.
Too bad there's nothing, then.
We'll do our best. All right, Sergeant. I want the neighborhood canvassed. Did anyone notice a small man sounding the drum? Did anyone see a small man leaving the premises? And check every carnival, fair, and circus for a small fellow who's a sharpshooter. One cartridge, one shot, and bullseye. Got that, Sergeant?
Aye, sir.
We can make a start anyway, and here's hoping...
Police routine. Sounding the drum. That's a new term. What does it mean? Listen to the sergeant as he canvasses the neighborhood.
Tell me, ma'am, in the past day or so, has anyone rung your bell and asked for someone who doesn't live here and left in a hurry?
Do you follow the term now? It's what Americans would call casing the joint. Find out if anyone's home by ringing the bell. If there is, make an excuse and get away fast. If there isn't, find a way to break in and steal whatever may be lying about within easy reach. It's simple, effective, very professional. But the police are professionals, too.
Excuse me, sir. I'm from the CID. Sergeant Gordon, my credentials.
Oh, what's up?
I'm making inquiries to see if anyone's called at your house in the past few days.
What? Oh, no. We've all been away the past 2 weeks. We only got back today.
Oh, well, thank you then. Sorry to trouble you.
Yes?
Forgive me for troubling you, ma'am. I'm Sergeant Gordon, CID. My credentials.
What's happened? We aren't in any trouble, are we?
Now, calm yourself, ma'am. No trouble for you, at any rate. It's just that I wanted to ask you a question or two.
Oh, yes.
Could you tell me if anyone has called at your house during the past few days and asked for someone who doesn't live here, and that if they were in?
What a silly question.
No, ma'am, it's a very serious question. So, will you put your mind to it?
Well, no. I'm absolutely sure. Nobody.
Yes? Sergeant Gordon, CID. My credentials.
Yes?
Has anyone rang your bell in the past few days and asked for someone who doesn't live here?
No.
Thank you.
Yes?
Sorry to disturb you, ma'am. I'm Sergeant Gordon, CID. My credentials.
Oh, please. Yes?
Did you... That is, has anyone rung your bell in the past few days and asked for someone who doesn't live here?
Oh, that'd be a foolish thing. Why, yes. There was. Just yesterday afternoon. He asked for a chauffeur or something. Said the fellow worked at the Beacon Garage.
And you remembered this?
Oh, I certainly did.
Why, ma'am?
Well, because there's no such place hereabouts as the Beacon Garage. And I ought to know. I've lived here 20 years.
I see. Rather a foolish error.
Now that you mention it, I'm not sure that it was an error. He seemed rather a nasty little man.
Oh, is that so? Why?
Too dapper, too quick. Much too little for a man. He was shorter than I am, and I'm only 5'2".
Could you describe him in more detail, perhaps?
Well, he had dark hair, grew very low on his head. And his eyes were sort of shifty. Blue, but shifty.
Uh-huh.
A kind of thing you see in the cinema. You know, in those pictures about bookmaking and that.
Anything else, ma'am?
Well, not that I remember. Not offhand, at any rate.
Now, two people still living have seen this little man, the dead man's son, and the woman at whose door he sounded the drum. A description is in hand, two descriptions, which tally in every point. And then Sergeant Gordon came into Inspector Howard's office with another fact, a very solid fact.
What's this, Sergeant? The weapon, sir. Found it behind the hedge of number 21, 3 houses up from the flats where Flyer was killed.
How'd you get onto it?
We found a young fellow who'd been walking his girl past the flats on her way from the bus. This little man ran out of the flats, almost knocked the girl over, but he kept going. Our young fella turned around to protest, saw him throw something over the hedge. We looked. There it is.
Nasty little gun. Well, shell jammed in the chamber.
No wonder he fired only one shot.
But he pulled the trigger twice. Well, we can drop our search in the circuses, Sergeant. I doubt if this fellow is the sharpshooter we thought he was. I think now we'll concentrate on classification by size. Shall we get to it, Sergeant? We seem to have our work cut out for us again.
Surely the picture takes shape. Dim at first, as if seen through frosted glass. Like the glass shards to be seen today in the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Again, it's compounded of hard work, good police training, and a little luck. They start with nothing, this time with a wrong theory that their man is a sharpshooter. They have to abandon this, and they start fresh with the dullest and therefore the hardest kind of police routine, checking the files.
He's a little man. Everyone's agreed on that. Ask criminal records to send us the dossiers on every man we have on file under 5 feet 2 inches in height.
Carefully, the inspector in charge and his sergeant comb through these dossiers. And finally, by reason of cross-checking, this one in jail at the moment of the crime, that one in some other part of the country, others with perfect alibis, the list of little fellows is reduced to 4.
You take these 2, Sergeant. I'll work over the others. Anything that rings a bell, the smallest detail.
Yes, sir.
For over an hour, the 2 men are silent, reading, thinking, trying to relate something in the files to the facts that they already have. And then they exchange dossiers and start again. By this time, the lamps are lighted. The Thames flows like black glass outside the window of the inspector's office. All at once.
I may have something, sir.
Which file?
Larry Mason. His nearest relatives, an uncle and an aunt, are recorded here as living in Beacon Road.
Does that mean anything to you, Sergeant? It doesn't to me.
You'll see it in my report in passing, Inspector. When I talked with the woman who'd seen the fellow sounding the drum, he told her the chauffeur he was looking for worked at the Beacon Garage.
Oh.
And she made quite a fuss over the fact that there is no such garage in the neighborhood. She was quite emphatic about it.
Interesting. Let me see the description. I see. 5 feet 1.5 inch. The smallest of the lot. Beacon Garage, eh? And relatives on Beacon Road.
Not important, perhaps. And yet, all important, as the inspector thought it through.
We'll say a man needs a false name at a sudden moment. He says the first thing that comes into his mind. It seems rather natural that the place his nearest relatives live should be lurking somewhere just below his consciousness. Well, it's mighty slim, but it's worth a try.
And having decided it was worth a try, Inspector Howard and Sergeant Gordon set out to trace their prime, if tiny, suspect.
Mason? Yes, he lived here.
Oh, lived? You mean he's left?
He didn't leave.
What then, ma'am? Did he die?
He could have, for all I care. I threw him out. Didn't pay his rent for 3 weeks. I can't afford deadheads, I can't.
Have you any idea where he's gone?
No. What's more, I don't care.
Next point of inquiry was the Beacon Road address and Larry Mason's uncle.
About your nephew, Mr. Mason.
What about him?
Have you any idea of his whereabouts?
Who wants to know?
My name is Howard, Inspector, Scotland Yard.
In trouble, is he again?
We're not certain yet. He may be. We'd like to talk to him.
Well, if you find him, I'd like to talk to him, too. Long enough to tell him not to come round for me for help.
Sergeant Gordon visited the pubs and hangouts where Larry Mason had been known to spend his time. In one of them, he found a friend of Mason's.
Larry? I ain't seen him in a long time. Not since he was sent away for breaking and entering. He hasn't been round at all. And I can't say I'm sorry.
No? Why not, friend?
He worked for me when I had my license and was making a book legitimate. He was my clerk, see? Then one day he walks off, just like that, with 10 quid. Huh. I don't expect to see him again. He knows that little job cost me my license. And he knows what'll happen to him if he shows his face in here again.
Not much to go on, or to find a man, except the brush strokes that fill the picture of the little fellow's character. Unreliable, a thief, where his friends are concerned. Now, think back a minute. Remember the Daily Gazette the Yard publishes with descriptions of stolen goods, missing persons, and so on.
Teletype from the Lancashire Police Inspector, huh? They've got the bracelet in the fly case. A pawnbroker turned it up.
Good.
It was offered to him by a tall, heavy-set fellow with a peculiar circular scar on his right cheek.
That sounds like Dick Lowry. Let's have Mr. Lowry in here, shall we?
Mr. Lowry was quite glad to oblige. He wasn't in hiding, anything like that, not Dick Lowry.
Where'd you get it, Lowry? The inspector wants to know.
Where'd I get what?
The bracelet you pawned in Bolton.
I found it.
You found it,
didn't you? That's what I said. Anything wrong in that?
If you found it, no. We think you bought it.
Well, now, what would I buy a bracelet with sparklers in it for? My girls don't go for that sort of thing.
You sold it, didn't you?
Oh, of course. Why not? Fellow can do with a spot of cash.
Larry.
Yes, Inspector?
You may want to know. That bracelet is involved in a killing.
A killing, is it? Why, that dirty little...
Oh? Go on, Lowry. Start talking, Lowry. Accessory after the fact in a murder can be very nasty, you know.
All right. I bought it. I paid a good price, too.
From whom? Lowry, from whom?
Larry Mason.
Well, at last. Where'd you see him, Lowry?
Oh, the usual place. Dog track. With him, it's horses or dogs when the nags aren't running.
Finally, the patience was bringing results, as it almost always does. Canvass a whole neighborhood, comb through hundreds of files, slowly, slowly, narrow the possibilities, and finally, a direct relation is established between the crime and some person who may have committed it. After that, find the person. In this case, it was the dog tracks. South End.
He's not here, Sergeant.
The White City Raceway.
Not a sign, Inspector.
Wembley.
They know him here, but he hasn't been around in weeks.
And back to South End.
No luck again, sir.
No luck is right. Tell me, Sergeant, do you suppose a pint of ale will help our patients any?
Aye.
This one seems rather decent, Inspector.
Yes, let's get on with it.
Excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I didn't mean to come against you.
That's all right. No harm done.
Hold it, young fellow. I think I know you.
Do you? Where from?
You're Larry Mason.
Not me. My name's Leonard Martin, sir.
Sorry, you'll have to prove your identity. We're from Scotland Yard.
A twist of luck, a turn of chance. Two weary policemen in search of a relaxing moment run across the killer they've been hunting for weeks. At the yard, Larry Mason was not having a particularly relaxing time of it.
Do you insist on denying you're Larry Mason?
I do.
Look, Mason, you've been away for a while. Now you know about these things. Your fingerprints are the prints on Mason's record. Dick Lowry swears he bought the bracelet from you. Your landlady and your former bookmaking associate have identified you. Now let's have no more nonsense.
I ain't giving you a thing. Just because I'm small don't mean you can push me around.
Ah, you'd better tell us the whole story, Mason, and stop this nonsensical denial. You'll go to trial anyway, you know. And the more you lie now, the harder it'll be on you later. Now speak up, Mason.
You know, they get stubborn streaks sometimes. They read somewhere, somehow, that the best defense is to admit nothing, not even their own identity. So they firmly shut their mouths and refuse to talk about anything except the weather. The sergeant knew they had a case, a good case. Inspector Howard came in to help.
I look at it this way, Mason. You can't do yourself any harm. We've got the evidence, we've got the gun. We're in the process of tracing it to you right now. The woman you spoke to will identify you in court. You had the bracelet. You've no alibi worth mentioning. You'll hang on what we've got, Mason, unless you've something which makes it manslaughter in place of murder.
All right. It was an accident. I never used a gun before. Never even had one.
The first time is always one too many when it comes to guns. Now keep talking. How was it an accident?
I broke the glass, see? After nobody answered the bell. I stuck my hand in. It was a cinch to open the door. I worked fast, but this fella come home early or something. I tried to make the back door. No luck, it was locked with a key.
So you had to come to the front.
He was a lot bigger than me. I pulled a gun because I wanted to scare him, that's all. He jumped me, hit me with something. I blacked out. That's it, I blacked out. Didn't even hear the gun go off.
And when you came to, Mason?
He was dead on the floor. I got out of there as fast as I could get. It was an accident. I'll swear it was an accident.
What's your opinion, Sergeant? It's a good story, but it won't wash.
Why not? That's what happened. Why not?
It's very simple, Mason. You blacked out as you pulled the trigger. Therefore, you fired only once.
Yes, sir. Only once.
Sorry, Mason. You pulled that trigger twice. There was a shell jammed in the firing chamber. You pulled the trigger at least twice. That's no accident, Mason. That's murder.
Yes, the case was complete. Each part in its correct place. And those glass shards I told you about, those two are in their correct place. In the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment. Person is Orson Welles.
The jury quite agreed with Inspector Howard. That was no accident. And so in due course, little Larry Mason, the bookies clerk who made the fatal error of carrying a pistol, went the way of most murderers at 8 o'clock one summer morning. Larry Mason's luck had run out, or had it? It was reported, you see, that as he walked to the scaffold with its 13 steps and waiting rope, Mason murmured to his guards, they had to do this now on June 6th, Derby Day, and me with a few shillings riding on Armstrong in the big race. Curiously, although Mason wasn't available to collect on his bet, Armstrong was the winning horse at 53-1. And now until we meet next time, until we meet in the same place and I tell you another story about the Black Museum, I remain as always obediently yours.
The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, is presented by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Radio Attractions. The program is written by Ara Marion, with original music composed and conducted by Sidney Torch. Produced by Harry Allen Towers.